even talking to you. I'm lonely. I need you. I need you.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, ICE raids commence across the country. Folks taken into custody during raids from New Jersey to California, troops to the border. Meanwhile, refugee rights activists mobilize to counteract the ICE attacks. We'll spend the hour on the mobilization to fight back against this attack. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. By the way, we are in Berkeley at the Mothership. My name is Dennis Bernstein. It's your daily investigative news magazine. We're going to focus, have a spotlight on what's been going on from coast to coast in terms of these Trump sweeps. And as we said in the introduction, troops to the border. We're going to talk about why they're mobilizing a fort in Texas. There's a lot to talk about, but we're going to start with the senior producer of this show, our own Miguel Gavila Molina, who has worked with us for so many years and at the station at La Onda Bajita. Miguel, you've been on the run since you were born. What are you thinking about in the context of what we're seeing now with these sweeps, mobilizing military forts, thousands of troops to the border?
It's chilling and frightening, but I'm not afraid. I'm just concerned, frightened, and concerned about this country and its well-being. To watch this supremacist dictator that lied his way and conned his way into the White House has made, and throughout his campaign, he made it clear that he was going to mobilize the whatever it would take to cleanse this country of the enemy within, which he has targeted as us. It's disheartening. Because here we are, 2025. This should be the age of Aquarius. I've been waiting for it, you know, for the last 50 years. And instead, we get a massive darkness that not only is going to affect the undocumented and refugee communities, but it's going to affect everybody. You know, sweeps and raids into schools and into churches are going to upset not just brown folks, but I think everyone that doesn't believe in using the military on domestic soil within the United States, you know, territories to launch this domestic war. He's utilizing military against people that don't have weapons, aren't armed, aren't part of any insurrection, which he was part of 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And so I'm really concerned, Dennis. But there's a lot of organizing. We've been through this before. In the 30s, millions were deported. 1950s, millions upon millions were deported, most of them children. And here we are now in a debate at the Big Hill at the White House about whether children born, U.S. citizens, born in this country of undocumented parents might not be or have the right to citizenship. It's an outrage to the Constitution and everything that is civil and you know, part of civil society.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Miguel, let's bring in Isabel Garcia and our own regular contributor, Camila Perez Bustillo. Both of these folks, attorneys, have been on the front line in this issue. Isabel from Arizona and Miguel here from the Bay Area. Welcome, both of you, to Flashpoints. Let me start with you, Isabel. Give us a sense of what's happening on the ground there. I think you're talking to us from Tucson. What are the things that you've been thinking about in this context? And what does this moment mean to you now?
Thank you very much for having me tonight. But this moment reflects really everything that we've been predicting, that we've been fighting against, and we have a realization in moments like this, the election of this man, that we have failed completely in teaching our foundational histories. We teach lies about our foundational histories. We don't teach the truth, and so voila, do we expect to have an educated, informed public? Absolutely not. They don't understand that we were founded on the genocide of indigenous and land theft. We don't teach about slavery and the alleged reconstruction. We don't teach about the greatest movement next to eliminating slavery, the labor movement that changed the bottom line for everybody. And we don't teach the foundation of the people moving here, the history of immigration. And so we're not shocked. We're not surprised. We've been fighting for years for the Interior to pay attention to us, to understand that what happens at the border is simply a laboratory and doesn't stay here. So people for years, well, Isabel, we have to have a secure border, so the Border Patrol's okay. We just have to have immigration and legalization, but it's okay to have a safe border. Well, look what we've grown. Not only a huge Border Patrol, but all of you in the Interior, in California, in the north of California, in Washington, in Iowa. We have ICE now. That's a Border Patrol. Same thing. And no one listened to the border people for so many years, and now the Democrats have failed us spectacularly in terms of not being able to defend the immigrant, who was the number one target for the Republicans to either stay quiet or to be Trump light. Was just horrific for us. I mean, they couldn't even tell the truth that their own think tanks revealed to them, that but for the undocumented immigrant, we wouldn't be the number one economy in the world. That the workers who fell into that bridge working at 3 a.m. were undocumented men from Honduras, Mexico, and Guatemala. Did any of them defend us? Well, no. Absolutely not. They all gave in. Our own senator, democratically elected Gallego, was a co-sponsor of the Lincoln-Riley bill. And so we're not really surprised. We're frightened, of course, because I've never really seen a mass deportation. But when they promise one, we better be awake and ready to be in action.
Isabel, how are you getting ready? Are people starting to think about getting ready? What does that mean in Tucson?
We've
there at
been
the
getting
border?
Ready. we've been getting ready because of this Proposition 314, which is like SB 4 in Texas, which establishes illegal entry, which is already a federal crime, into a state offense. In Arizona, they also tied it to fentanyl, even though migrants don't bring in the fentanyl, and voila, we passed 314. And so just since his inauguration, we have had I-9 raids. I myself have witnessed the freeway stops, city stops, business raids. We've closed the border, stopped the CBP. We stopped the Sileys. We've halted all the TPS visa holders. We have the military, 1,500 going into. We have unmarked vehicles. We've been taking photographs. And, of course, the deaths continue. I just have to remind you that in 2003, when DHS was created, nobody paid attention but to us, but they said it clearly. We have a prevention through deterrence program, which means prevention through death policies, and we have the whole of government policy, and we have now embraced it, not only with Trump declaring nationally, but Prop 314 essentially collapses. Yes, we have all adopted the vision and mission of the Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection. So here we are. Here we are.
Well, let me ask you, Isabel, which is a big concern, and I've been hearing a lot of, there's a lot of rumors everywhere, but have you seen the military? Has there been military convoys? Because that's one thing that people here in California, the California Highway Patrol is actually Sacramento, the capital's police force. And, you know, one thing the governor said here and throughout California is that we are not, the state is not going to participate in helping or assisting federal authorities. But when the army, when the military steps in, it's going to be a whole different game. But have you seen any movement of military in your area?
Actually, I have not, right? We've not heard any reports, but absolutely, it changes everything, right? I mean, as it is, we've been telling people for years that the Border Patrol is a civil law enforcement. They're not military, right? I mean, because it implicates a lot. Once you have the military, they're trained to kill. I mean, that's their duty. They're in war. And when they sent people to the Texas border, we saw the number of suicides, all kinds of criminal activity. I mean, it was just horrible with that particular deployment. What are they going to do now? They formed man camps in particular areas, causing really a lot of fear. So right now our community is gripped in fear. I have to tell you that. Even though we've had Know Your Rights trainings, and so people are getting equipped. We've had hundreds of people at our Know Your Rights trainings, how to stop being taken away, but we also, of course, development of emergency packets for the family and for work and for all of it. So we've been very, very busy. Not only that kind of preparation, but our commitment to document and attempt to stop the deportations, right? I mean, we are going to do that in accompaniment. We have 10 defense committees formed. I mean, we're going to fight back.
Now, let me jump in here, Isabel, and invite into the conversation an old friend of yours, somebody who was in the battle, Camilo Perez Bustillo. Camilo has been helping us here in the Bay Area and helping, you know, on the front line of this struggle for quite a while, as you know. Camilo, you've been watching this on the structural level, on the way in which the Trump administration means to administer the program. You want to talk about that? And for, I think it's Fort Hood.
Sure. First, it's really an honor to share this space with nuestra hermana Isabel, you know, with all the respect for her work that's embodied the best of what we've tried to do as communities to resist through the Derechos Humanos and throughout the border region. And we used to collaborate through the American Friends Service Committee. And so es un honor estar aquí con Isabel, but also with nuestro hermano Miguel. And what I wanted to bring to the table was what Dennis just alluded to. It's Fort Bliss in El Paso, which is from where one of the first military deportation flights took off this morning with 80 hermanos y hermanas of ours from Guatemala. It was a flight that was headed, again, on a military plane to Guatemala. You know, it's the fruit of all of the policies that have been activated over the last few days. But it's one key first example and case study of what this means. Look online for the images of our sisters and brothers in chains being loaded on this military flight, on this military plane. But there's an additional story about this. There's two layers. One is the significance of it being from Fort Bliss. As we were talking about earlier with Dennis, when I was based in El Paso at Hope Border Institute during the first Trump administration, we were involved in the campaign to shut down the migrant youth detention center at Tornillo. That was one of, you know, sort of the signal achievements of the first Trump administration. Mass detention of migrant youth. Tornillo was kind of, you know, the shining example from their perspective of that. After we were successful in shutting down Tornillo, where most of the kids were from Guatemala, so this is all connected, they got put in absolutely inaccessible detainment at Fort Bliss. So Fort Bliss was used as a detention center after we were able to shut down Tornillo. So there's a history here. The history of Fort Bliss as a site for migrant detention goes all the way back to 1917. This is why the history that Isabel was invoking is so important. Look online for the images. David Romo, a local historian in El Paso, has dug these up. They're online, of Mexicanos y Mexicanas, deportees getting ready to be sent back to Mexico, held behind barbed wire at an improvised detention center at Fort Bliss. That's 1917. That's where we're headed in 2025. And like we've talked about before, it's also the images that many of us have, and this is part of our history as well. Our history as communities of color in the U.S. is the history of Japanese detention in the 1940s under similar circumstances. Where one thing we always forget, and this is what's beginning to happen with the raids that we've been hearing about, including in Newark, New Jersey, the workplace raid, is U.S. citizens being among those detained. Because we don't carry our passports around with us, those of us who are citizens. It's not simple to demonstrate, to prove your citizenship, particularly under the circumstances of a raid. And it's very common, and it's been common since the mass deportations of the 1930s and the mass deportations of the 1950s and multiple instances since then, for citizens and green card holders, legal permanent residents, to be caught up in raids. And so there's always that spillover effect. But there's one more detail about the flight today from El Paso, from Fort Bliss, which is very important. According to recent reports, we're going to have to confirm this more, but part of what we do through Witness at the Border is track these flights. There are ways to track them through flight tracker mechanisms online. We've been doing that for the last 4 years at Witness at the Border. And what we can say is that apparently, I mean, again, we're going to need further confirmation. Mexico appears to have barred the U.S. from flying that plane full of deportees headed to Guatemala. There was a prohibition from Mexico of that going through Mexican airspace. So the deportation flight had to go all the way around the Yucatan first, and then through Costa Rica, a very circuitous route, which suggests that perhaps Honduras may have also denied permission. So this is one of the few ways in which countries like Mexico or countries like Honduras, in this case, can hold the line, can resist, can say, we are not going to play along with this. There are a million other ways, sadly, in which Mexico has cooperated. We've talked about this before many times on this program and in other spaces. There's sadly many ways in which previous Mexican governments and the current one have been complicit, sadly, with key aspects of U.S. policy. But in this case, there appears to have been a real statement and action of moral courage by the Mexican government. It may be a one-off thing, it might be an isolated incident, or it might be an indicator that the, I mean, you can't really call them negotiations, but that the exchanges back and forth between Mexico and U.S. may have run into some obstacles, and that things are going to get more and more difficult. This is key because one of the things Trump wants to do is reactivate the so-called Remain Mexico program, what were called the so-called migrant protection protocols, which produced a string of improvised tent city camps of migrants awaiting processing of their asylum cases on Mexican territory during the first Trump administration. And we had the possibility on this program of sharing that experience directly from Matamoros. That looks to be where we're headed again now. So keep your eyes on Fort Bliss, keep your eyes on these military deportation flights, and all of us need to understand what it means for the military to be directly authorized and enlisted in carrying out these racist, xenophobic, and ultimately genocidal policies.
Camilo, I wanted to ask you, because I'm really concerned about the military. This is armed forces. This is not National Guard. This is not the U.S. Border Patrol. You know, we're talking about military. Isn't there, to me, there has to be some kind of major, huge concern amongst the maybe the Democrats, because it's almost unheard where the United States uses its military on domestic grounds to, you know, to attack a certain population, to assault a population. And one thing that Isabel mentioned is when you bring in the armed forces, the military, they're there for combat. They're there to kill. So there must be some kind of major concern about that. And can it be...
The Posse Comitatus Act, it prohibits that. But, you know, they've made inroads in it. But that's what we have to say. Yes, the Posse Comitatus says that you cannot use military forces to enforce civilian law.
And that principle that Isabel just summarized, that would be the basis for challenging this, you know, direct implication of the military in an active way in what is in effect law enforcement on U.S. soil. But there's no guarantee that those challenges will be successful. And it doesn't really matter from the perspective of the administration, because we know, and this is something we've talked about before, this is not an administration that has a whit of concern about the rule of law. They're flouting the law, and they started to do it immediately with birthright citizenship, which is embedded in the 14th Amendment. You can't amend the Constitution through an executive decree, but that's what they're trying to do. And already one judge has stopped them, and other cases have been filed, and it may go all the way to the Supreme Court, and they might win at the Supreme Court, but that's not going to stop them meanwhile. Nothing can stop meanwhile local officials in red states at hospitals or in counties denying birth certificates on the basis of what Trump's trying to do with birthright citizenship.
They're already in the schools. Camillo, they're already in the schools.
Absolutely.
I mean, what about that?
We should talk about that because the Chicago incident actually became a little bit more complicated than we thought. We'll get back to that. But just one last thing. Marco Rubio, as Secretary of State, today can begin denying passports on the basis of the Trump administration's unconstitutional interpretation of birthright citizenship.
That's right.
Isabel, did you want to jump in?
No, that's you know, they're just trying to wipe away every possible thing. But I think we have to remember that they've done this from the beginning, right? To pass the Undesirable Aliens Act of 1929, it was racism against Mexicanos with the express intent to discriminate on the basis of race that it was set. I think in the past, I've read you that quote from Congressman Democrat from John Box from Texas in 1929, that described us in the most horrific ways, and saying that the prevention of this mongrelization and degradation is one of the purposes of our law, which the admission of these people will tend to defeat. We have continued on this mode of preventing entry, deporting, and finally to punish, because the most punished crime in the federal courts is unlawful entry. In all of the courts put together, you put together all the crimes, and unlawful entry is their number one crime. Imagine that.
Imagine what that means. And that's what they tried to do with zero tolerance during the first Trump administration, and that's what produced family separation. I mean, usually the stories are told kind of in a fragmented way. Some people focus on zero tolerance, some people focus on family separation. They work together as part of the same mechanism. But this is a breaking story, Dennis, that's really important for us all to share and continue to reflect about. It's now confirmed, NBC News is reporting, that Mexico denied a U.S. military plane access to land on Thursday, temporarily frustrating the Trump administration's plans to deport immigrants to the country, according to two U.S. defense officials and a third person. So there were two things that happened. Two Guatemala-bound planes, one of the ones that I was alluding to before, carrying about 80 people each, flew deportees out of the U.S., but were denied access to Mexican airspace. The third flight that was slotted to land in Mexico didn't take off because Mexico refused to permit it to land. Again, it might be an isolated incident, or it might be an indication that things are going to get very complicated very soon in U.S.-Mexico relations, and we're going to be having to mobilize solidarity with Mexico también.
Mm-hmm. All right, listen, we're out of time, but we are hoping that the both of you will continue to join us in this ongoing dialogue that we have been having for years, and Isabel, for decades, about this crucial and important, not just a story, but whether we're going to be able to all live together, or whether we're going to be living all together under a fascist state. We're keeping an eye on it, and we appreciate both of you for helping us. If people want to know more about you, Isabel, is there a way to follow your work?
Yes, at derechoshumanosaz.net. We're redoing our website, but yes, we've managed to in our Instagram as well, and Facebook, we're trying to put all our materials out there, and we're mobilizing, right? That's the main thing here. We're pushing the politicians, pushing the churches. I mean, you know, we're really trying to engage the entire city. If they're going to attack us in a frontal way, we've got to be on the streets. That's the bottom line.
Yes.
And we have to step up in support of organizations like Derechos Humanos, which is one of the historic organizations at the front lines of this struggle. Mm-hmm. Please also join us online with Witness at the Border. There's a website. And also there's our Facebook group, which has over 18,000 members. We're going to be migrating that group to another platform for obvious reasons. But at this point, it's still on Facebook, Witness at the Border. And we're going to be gathering in Ajo, Arizona for a regional conference. Hopefully, Isabel, si nos pueden acompañar, we're going to be in Ajo March 14th to 16th. But anyhow, we'll keep talking about that with you, Dennis. The thing about the schools in Chicago, it's been claimed that it was Secret Service, not ICE. There's still very contradictory reports about what happened, but it's absolutely clear that the Trump administration has said that they're going to go after what were previously described as sensitive locations like schools, hospitals, and churches. And we know that faith-based groups are fighting back and resisting, like the Episcopal bishop, right? Or like the Bishop of El Paso, Bishop Seitz. So that's what we have to look to as well. Back to the what we all know as the sanctuary movement. That's where we are as also.
Yeah. Isabel, final word.
Thank you very much. I think that I've never witnessed a mass deportation, so I think we better all listen up and be ready to resist, to accompany, and to document what's happening to our community.
Thank you so much. We will keep this dialogue going. We owe you a great deal. We're going to take a very short musical break. We're going to come back and continue this dialogue with Francisco Herrera and a very special guest. Stay with us.
Un fuerte abrazo para Francisco.
Contigo porque te amo, porque hemos unido sueño y pasión, porque te conozco y me conoces en lo más profundo del corazón. A diario te veo y lo confirmo, contigo completo todo mi ser. Es como encontrar un tesoro perdido.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gabriel Molina, joining us from down south is our resident troubadour Francisco Herrera, who's also a reporter for this show. And Francisco, introduce, we have a very special guest. Tell us, you're in Half Moon Bay, why are you there? And tell us who you're there with. Francisco?
I was there, unless he got cut off. He was there.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you,
Francisco. Do you got me?
Use one phone because we're all here. Yes, can you hear me?
Now we just heard you for the first time. Please.
Okay. Well, buenas tardes. Here we are in La Media Luna, the Half Moon Bay in Califatlan, Dennis, and here with two superstars of the human rights, human being movement. Belinda Hernandez Arriaga and Elizabeth Rodriguez, who's visiting us from the Farm Worker Ministry. She's from Mero, Texas, right there. And we are commemorating here at the ALAS, the center here in Half Moon Bay, a horrific event last year. And we actually have one of the survivors who will be with us tonight, who will receive 5 bullets. But the horrible thing of this massacre that happened here in Half Moon Bay in the farm worker community is that it exposed the horrific living conditions that farm workers are living on. You know, like Isabel said, we, the working people, and particularly farm workers, have made this economy, the United States, the number one economy in the world, and yet it's been a blood-sucking industry of sickness that has produced horrific situations. With us, I'm going to pass on to Belinda, our wonderful Dr. Belinda Hernandez Arriaga, and tell us, just remind us a little bit, Belinda, what happened last year.
Well, today marks the second year anniversary of this mass shooting. Thank you for having me on the show, because it's a story that we don't want to forget ever. We have to remember, we have to continue to stand on the front lines. We have to continue to push for farm worker rights, mental health, dignified housing. And so today we remember the seven campesinos that lost their lives with a lot of sadness, but also a lot of resolve to keep pushing forward so that their lives are not lost in vain.
Gracias. And we also have with us Elizabeth Rodriguez, who's visiting with a whole group of people from the National Farm Worker Ministry. Elizabeth, welcome. You're coming all the way from Texas.
Yes. Thank you for having me. I am a farm worker advocate from La Frontera, from South Texas, the Rio Grande Valley, Hidalgo County, and we house the most farm workers in the state of Texas.
I'd like to, this is Dennis Bernstein here. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are honored to have you all with us, and I would like to hear from each of you, including you, Francisco, what is on your mind now? What is the focus, given that we're now clearly witnessing a president who is willing to use executive power to arrest, to round up, to deport? We've seen the first flight today. What's going through your minds, and what do you think we need to know about what's happening?
You know, it's just so sad, because here we are grieving the lives of seven farm workers that gave everything for our community, for all of us, and they do that every day across our state, across our country, and yet they're being vilified, they're being criminalized, they're being dehumanized along with all our immigrant community. And so I'm from a mental health perspective as a licensed clinical social worker, and what we're doing is adding trauma to our communities, to our children, to our abuelos, abuelitas, to the most vulnerable. And these raids, these threats, these policies are having a direct effect on the mental health psyche of our community, on the physical wellness of our community. And it's real. You know, the fear is real. And here we are trying to grieve the loss, but yet we're already grieving collectively across our community the fear that people are living and seeing, and this injustice. I'm horrified at it. I'm mad. But as I told Francisco when we were at the Day of Resistance March, and what gave me hope, and you know, talking to Gavilán that day, que nosotros, that we are the la resistencia. Somos la resistencia. We are the resistance. And we can't lose sight of that. We cannot go back. We can't hide. Like, we have to stand together, stand strong, stand united, and our culture is what's going to keep us safe, keep us united, and we're going to fight. And here we are, estamos aquí. Yeah.
On my mind is the devastation that is spreading across our community, the hate that is being driven into the hearts of our amazing, resilient communities, and working with farm workers, working with migrants, mm-hmm. living on the border of Texas. I come from a community that is heavily militarized, so it's not new to us. People are undocumented community. They try to stay away from the border, but they often fear just going to Walmart for fear of being targeted by state patrol or border patrol if they get too close to the border, and being deported. But more than that, this is devastating to the entire community, because even those people who are supporting these actions have no idea how this is going to impact their lives as well. This is going to be a disaster on our economy, and it is going to affect the people that basically exploit immigrants and use them to their benefits to make themselves richer every day, but it's also going to drive the cost of food and other products up in our communities. It is counterproductive to our communities, and these people, these immigrants, documented or undocumented, they face horrible conditions, exploitation, and still, you know, they see this land as an opportunity for them to prove themselves. And so my concern is going to be for our entire country, for everybody, because the ramifications of these actions, they're going to be long lasting. Our future generations will be talking about this moment for generations to come. We are on the cusp of a breakdown of our economy, of our nation, and my fear is that there's not enough being done to make sure that our country survives this impact.
And thank you, Alexa. And for me, Dennis, I know we have to start in 5 minutes of the program here, but for me, I'm remembering my father being born in a garage in my little town of Calexico, and in a time when it was popular to see signs in restaurants that said no blacks, dogs, or Mexicans served in this restaurant. And for me, what's in my mind again is right now is really the intention of the MAGAs. I mean, MAGA is really make America slave again, which is what that is. You know, it's like we're the first, but their idea is to make the rich richer and the working class a slave. So we are really on a fight for our country, a fight for our lives, and it's time to organize again, as our other generations who faced horrific violence were able to overcome this kind of attack. We can have to continue. Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you. That's Francisco Herrera reporting from the field. We appreciate those voices, Francisco, and all the work you're doing. I'm here in the studio with Aaron Miguel Gavilo Molina, and please, all of you, take care. This dialogue is going to continue, and we're going to provide a forum for those who are being pursued by this right wing expanding what's really turning into a dictatorship. So thanks to all of you. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the impact that the Trump policies are having, particularly on Haitians. You know, we've been covering the story of Haiti and the people's quest for self-determination for decades. This is another turn for the worse, and it's very troubling. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're now joined by Tom Jowitz. He's a senior fellow at American Progress. He's a former senior lawyer in the Homeland Security Department in the Biden administration. And he knows a great deal about immigration. And we're going to be talking about the implications facing thousands of Haitians and folks from other countries that are now being sort of pushed off the political plank and having an extraordinarily important program undermined by Trump, creating a great deal of suffering. Mr. Tom Jowitz, welcome to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. Great to be on.
It's good to have you with us. Could you take a moment to describe the program that you worked on with the Biden administration, and then tell us the implications in terms of how it's being, you know, being dismantled, and what that means for a whole bunch of people?
Sure. Well, you know, interestingly, there actually are a number of different programs that Haitians have benefited from over the years. And so, you know, and the interesting thing is that, you know, they're not all mutually exclusive. And so there are individuals who've come through one program or another who, while they're on a program, have benefited from yet another program. And so, you know, it can be a complicated mix of acronyms and things like that. The one that I think many people may be familiar with, and which certainly quite a number of Haitians have benefited from over the years, is temporary protected status. TPS is a status that was created by Congress in 1990, and essentially it authorizes the Secretary of Homeland Security to determine that, you know, when a country meets certain conditions that are described in the statute, including where there's ongoing armed conflict that makes it unsafe for people who are from that country to be forced to return there, the secretary can designate that country for temporary protected status, and nationals in the United States as of the designation date are able to, if they passed, you know, a screening threshold and if they don't have certain criminal convictions, are able to get that protection, typically for 18-month periods. And with that protection from deportation and detention comes the ability to work. So there are, at this point, basically, there are about 260,000 Haitians in the U.S. today who currently have temporary protected status. And because of a redesignation of that program by the Biden administration a year or so ago, there may well still be a couple hundred thousand more who may be able to apply for TPS up until about February of 2026. And so that's one program that's out there. To date, the Trump administration has done nothing to undermine that program. And so it is still there. It is still available for new applicants to apply for, so long as they came here prior to a particular date. And that's still there. The Trump administration, folks may remember, did try to destroy Haitian TPS the last time they were in office. But that effort was unsuccessful ultimately because it was blocked in the courts and then was ultimately overridden by positive Biden administration actions. I think the program you're talking about, and I'm happy to give you a time here, but I think you're talking about the parole process could be another one of the programs that you want to hear more about, I think.
Yeah, well, that the parole status, explain that. We are interested in sort of understanding who is now in jeopardy, why, and ultimately how they might be able to fight back. So maybe you can help sum that up for
us. So that's another population. I mean, I think the Haitian TPS population certainly is one. The Haitian parole population is another. And as I mentioned at the outset, there are some folks who came through this parole program who have actually been able to apply for TPS as well. So they may be currently maintaining parole status and also be applicants for TPS or TPS holders. But basically with the Biden administration data, this is a major sort of philosophy shift with regard to managing migration, is one of the strategies they put in place a couple of years ago is to say, we've got, you know, such difficulty managing our migration flows at the southwest border, in part because there is a huge demand of people who want to come here, but we do not have sufficient lawful and safe pathways through which they can come. And so if we're going to have a lot of migration, particularly because the United States economy and job market was booming, certainly in comparison to a lot of other parts of the world, and then obviously there's a measure of safety and security and stability here that there's not in Haiti and in some of the countries in which Haitians had settled prior to coming to the U.S. what they essentially decided was, we're going to create, using this authority that's also created by Congress, the parole authority, the ability for certain people from certain countries, if they have sponsors in the United States, to be approved for travel to come to the U.S. on their own dime, and they can come here for a period of 1 year, or typically 2 years, basically. They get a two-year parole period where, so long as they don't try to cross the border irregularly, but they instead sort of say where they are, get this approval, and then fly themselves directly into the U.S., into an airport where we can properly screen them and vet them and scan them and figure out if they merit entry into the country, that's the way they should come. And it was a very successful program. You know, it was one of the pieces the Biden administration put in place that very effectively channeled what was, you know, an overwhelmingly irregular migration flow at the Southwest border into an overwhelmingly safe, legal, and orderly migration flow to the ports of entry, both along the Southwest border and into the interior. And so today there are probably about 260,000 Haitians who have at this point come to the United States through the parole processes. I'm sorry, but more, 210,000 who have come to the U.S. through the Haitian parole processes, and are in the United States. They're able to work lawfully, and that's the status they have. In some circumstances, they're able to apply for adjustment of status if they have some basis to get a green card. Many of them, if they are able to and if they wish, can apply for asylum. But that's basically what, where a lot of these folks, how they got in and what their current status is while they're here. What the Trump administration announced it intends to do, in a memorandum the Secretary of Homeland Security, acting secretary, issued last night, is that they want to consider individuals who have come in through these various parole programs on a case-by-case basis and decide, first and foremost, whether or not they want to terminate their parole early, essentially, take action to take away the parole they have, which would also take away their work authorization and their ability to stay in the country, and then separately, whether and how they want to try and remove them from the country. And so for a number of these parolees, the threat, at least, is that the government would take some steps to take away their parole, take away their work authorization, potentially put them in detention, and depending upon certain factors that are not very clearly, you know, laid out in the memo, either put them into deportation proceedings or potentially put them through another deportation process that provides very, very little due process, provides no access to a court, and really expeditious removal from the country. And so that's the current threat, I think, and uncertainty facing a lot of Haitians, but also, frankly, Cubans and Nicaraguans and Venezuelans and potentially even Ukrainians and Afghans and lots of other folks who came through these kinds of parole processes in the last couple of years.
I tell you, I would, if I had anything to say about it, I'd change the name of that program, because parole suggests that somebody needs to be liberated based on some crime that they commit. So there is, although maybe... there's something to be said to the title, but I find that troubling. But I am concerned. So, and is there another program? It seems that we saw the first flight out tonight. About 80 people were taken out of the country. I'm not sure where they were taken to. Do you know? But clearly, that signals there are going to be more of those kinds of flights. I guess some of the people you've been describing here in terms of under that parole program might be facing this kind of immediate deportation. What are you hearing about actual sweeps, about people being arrested, about structures being created to mass deport folks? Are you hearing anything about that? What do you know on that front?
Yeah, it's too early. I mean, you know, one thing we know about the Trump administration is that they're mass propagandists. And so we already knew that one thing we were going to see is that the kind of stuff that was happening every single day up until January 20th, when Trump took office, was going to suddenly become, you know, an extraordinary demonstration of successful immigration enforcement rather than an open borders, you know, laissez-faire attitude toward the current immigration system, right? And so a lot of run-of-the-mill stuff that, you know, either wasn't getting a lot of publicity before or, you know, was being trumpeted but not being really pushed in certain circles is now being stamped with, you know, Trump's deportations are back kind of message. And so you're getting a lot more promotion from the White House press secretary, you know, tweeting this morning, you know, deportations are back on. you know, deportations were at extremely high levels during the Biden administration. Certainly over the last couple of years, they were higher than they were during the Trump administration. And the Obama administration had higher numbers as well. And so, you know, the immigration enforcement process is something that Democrats and Republicans both have pursued, I'd say, with vigor for many, many years now. But now that it's the Trump administration, it's going to be something that we sort of put their brand on and sort of describe as being this massive success. So, for instance, ICE was pushing, Immigration and Customs Enforcement was pushing out in their social media and through the public releases the number of people who they had arrested each day in the last couple of days. That number basically is pretty much on par with the average that we were seeing from the Biden administration from the last couple of days. But again, because they're putting it out so publicly, it's trying to create the impression that none of this was happening beforehand. That is not to say that there was not going to be any changes. There are not going to be changes going forward. I think we're seeing an incredible number of policy changes happening very, very quickly over the first week. And, you know, I think we're still potentially expecting to see more in the next couple of days as well, even as we head into, you know, the beginning of the second week. And it's just going to take time for that to materialize and for us to see exactly what happens with it. And so there absolutely are pieces being put in play that could expedite actually effective immigration enforcement, like, you know, the actual effect on people. But the immediate effect that we're absolutely seeing and hearing from the community is that the fear level has just ramped up to an entirely new level. And that itself really has an impact, obviously, on people's everyday lives.
We just have a minute left. Is there legal? Are there legal remedies? Are there structures created for these folks? Are they going to be suffering at all levels? What is there any way to fight this in the courts, or is this a done deal? It's sort of like get on the plane. And I mean, if you're being deported back to Haiti, anybody who has been following this show knows a great deal about the violence on the ground and the failure, years, decades of failure of U.S. policy leading to a desperate situation. It would be a most extraordinary time to deport people. It would. I think former President Aristide talked about what U.S. policy is sort of like pushing people fleeing a fire, pushing them back into the fire and closing the door on them. What do we know about the legal remedies?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I would just address it on a number of different levels. So, on the highest level, one of the things that was the most successful during the Trump administration, the first time of pushing things back, was this impact litigation, was, you know, civil rights organizations, human rights organizations going to court and actually having a fairly good success rate at rolling back a number of the most egregious policies on immigration that the Trump administration tried to do. And one reason for that, I mean, and this sort of goes to something else your listeners may have heard of, which is the Trump administration really, really has a disdain for the civil service, the government, federal government workers whose careers are to, you know, work in these departments and become truly expert in their area of expertise, in their area of statutory law and policy. You know, they get run roughshod when the Trump administration is in power. It happened the first four years, and it's happening again right now. You know, we're seeing senior staff, career civil servants being fired from their jobs because the president has the view that, and this goes to your opening about sort of a dictatorship, this idea that the Constitution and Article 2 bestows upon him all these special powers that allow him to override the laws of the country. And so they're invoking that to just fire people who have been in their jobs for 15, 20 years and have genuine civil service protections. But because they don't listen to the people who have been there for so long, they don't listen to the lawyers who are expert in these areas of the law, they often make mistakes. And that was one of their downfalls during the first 4 years when we had a lot of success in rolling back their policies in the courts. Now, the courts are often not our friends, and the courts have gotten more hostile over the years. And so it's we don't have confidence that we're going to find friendly forums with a lot of these lawsuits. But very often we're in the right on the law, and in the past at least, that has often mattered. So one, there will absolutely still be litigation, and you saw that very early this week when a federal court judge in Washington State blocked temporarily the president's
executive order. Yes, that was good news. We have 30 seconds. 30 seconds.
I think the only last thing I say is, too, I think we absolutely need representation for individuals. So any of your listeners out there who are lawyers or who can be accredited representatives to go into immigration court. We need folks to be talking to immigrants and providing screenings and legal representation. And three, community support, just making sure there are community members out there who are looking out for their neighbors and are making sure that they have the kind of support, mental, emotional, and otherwise that they would need at this time.
Mr. Drawitz, we appreciate the information and you taking out the time to be with us tonight on Flashpoints. Please stay safe.
Yeah, thank you very much. Take care.
You're very welcome. And you're listening to, yeah, Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio tonight at the Mothership. If you're in the Bay Area, you listen to KPFA, you want to tune in to La Onda Bajita tonight. You do not want to miss it.
And no, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Here we go again, it's the game we love.
Play game.
Tune in on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m. for Winner's Bias, a new show exploring the culture around tabletop games.